Welcome back to Battery Generation, your e-mobility podcast for European battery research. Today, we have a great guest from the United States. Welcome, John Kem.
Great to be here, and thanks for inviting me to be part of it today.
John Kem, you are a retired U.S. Army two-star general. Now you're president of American Battery Factory, ABF. John, good to have you here. You are building up a gigafactory in Tucson, Arizona. How far are you, and what's your plan for the upcoming years?
American Battery Factory really grew up about 3 years ago from Lion Energy, which is based in Salt Lake City, Utah. And that's really a battery pack provider and doing, you know, cutting edge work. And they recognized that almost none of the materials that they were using were made in the U.S. or North America, for that matter. So trying to get a U.S. supply chain for lots of reasons became an important part. And battery cells are the most important part, right? All the wires and other stuff in battery packs, if you don't have good battery cells, you don't have a battery. So they recognized the need and wanted to go, how can we start to source this in the United States and just kind of have a more reliable and a really high-end product? And so with that, a lot of research, looking around, we decided to do it in Tucson, Arizona. And we did a groundbreaking in October of last year, a few months ago. And our construction, you know, the heavy earthwork will start in a few months. And we think we'll be complete in the mid-2025 with kind of commissioning and battery production by the end of 2025.
What are the locational advantages in Tucson, Arizona? Why did you pick that specific spot?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. So a lot of research on different places, you know, as the United States is a continent-sized, you know, country. So lots of choices. In the end, Arizona is a great spot for a couple of different reasons. One, electricity is fairly cheap. And land is much cheaper than lots of other places. We're basically on the south side of Tucson Airport. I know most people have never been there, but it's, I would call it kind of scrub desert. We're below the airport. There's almost no development there. So the land was available. Electricity's not very expensive. And we're not a huge water user. There's always a concern in, you know, the Arizona and the deserts about water use, but we're not a huge water user. So it ended up being a great location in just terms of physicality. And then the state was very supportive of the local government, Pima County, and trying to give some incentives for us to be there.
How many gigawatt hours a year will you be able to produce?
Our initial factory will be one factory line. The factory is pretty large. I guess I could, you know, it's 500 meters by about 50 meters wide. So it's a long, skinny factory. The closest thing, as you know, your leaders know, would be old paper mills would be the closest thing in the old days. And so in terms of location-wise, that works out really well. And then in terms of, you know, the air quality and other things, Arizona works out really nicely for us in terms of how to do it.
Do you actually plan on producing your own electricity as well? Since you mentioned you're in the desert, there's probably a lot of sun. You could maybe even put solar all over your roof. Is that on the horizon or is it?
We're not putting solar in up front just because in the near term, you know, you have to fund it. And getting local power until we start to have something to produce, it makes more sense to use local power. And we have pretty cheap electricity there. Secondly, we have a great partnership with Tucson Electric Power, who does lots of solar and other things. So our power supply is pretty decent in that regard.
We know there's multiple pretty innovative Chinese battery cell manufacturers, as well in Korea and in Japan. They are actually already able to supply the American automotive industry already today. So why does America, that's the core question of today, I guess, why does America need a domestic cell production?
I think there's lots of reasons. The one up front I would say is we're not focused on the EV car battery lane, right? We're really in the battery storage solutions. And even in the EV space, it's interesting that we're doing our chemistry is going to be lithium iron phosphate, right? We're not doing no nickel, no cobalt. So it's different than the typical battery you see in a Tesla and a Volkswagen and other kind of EV cars. And so it doesn't quite give the peak power, but it gives you much better long-term power. So that's really the kind of focus on where our energy is. And even though there are people who do produce them, we think we can bring together kind of high-end manufacturing technology that exists. You know, China really leads high-end manufacturing in battery cells, right? There's some European firms that do something similar, but not at the same scale. And so we think we can take what they do, but then bring in kind of high-end decision-making, AI and other things, and actually take it to the next level. So that's really kind of our focus on how to do it. I mean, that the reality is it's not super complicated, right? But the second part is capacity. So even though people go, well, the carb demand is being done today, we're way behind in battery storage, right? The long-term solution, I'll give it a, this is what both, it applies to Germany and countries in Europe. When the wind doesn't blow and the solar isn't lit up, what is your redundant power to provide it, right? In the long run, that's just to provide power today, right? If we go do an increased electrification for businesses and more cars and trucks and everything else, that takes even more. And then in the United States, we have fairly cheap power compared to Europe, but how do you get the power to the right place at the right time? And so battery storage solutions is kind of the solution, right? You need each home or business, I would argue, to have somewhere between 4 and 12 hours of backup power so that they could buy the power at the moment it's cheapest or have it redundant. And then it's a smart grid. It's actually sending who needs it when. But if for some reason yours was off for an hour, it wouldn't affect you.
What I don't get for now is the unique selling point. You can, of course, buy some LFP batteries in China as well. So I guess we're talking about building up the American domestic market. As a European, I understand that the American IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is somewhat targeted towards building up that domestic US-made battery game. But one might even think that the US is considering cell production even as a matter of national security. Does that make sense to you as a former US two-star general?
I would say it does and it doesn't. So I don't think it's not a military pure security part, right? I think there's two parts to this. First of all, the demand is going to go up dramatically. As we start to do battery storage everywhere, we need so much more than we can produce today. So first of all, if we can do it at a reasonably competitive price, there's value add to that. It's a more guaranteed supply chain. You avoid shipping across oceans. You avoid if some international incident happens and tariffs and all the things that can happen in the global stage, you avoid all that. So we think all that is a powerful reason why people would want our battery cells. And then especially in our mind, LFP batteries are the ones for the future, at least the next 5 to 10 years. And if we can produce them reliable with a reasonable price, they have much more longevity than the nickel cobalt batteries, NMC. And so we think we can, the demand is enough to still need the ones from overseas, but also need ours by a long shot.
So you're saying the main reason is the future demand that you see, not so much a geopolitical argument to be had. Because that's something we have in Europe all the time right now, because we are importing very heavily from China. And for us, this is actually an important thing to get to chemistries that we can mine over here, maybe sodium ion technologies, and to have the capacities to produce these batteries, which we are currently ramping up. But so you would say that's not the main reason, the geopolitical thing. It's more the pure demand that you see.
If you can't do it in a cost-effective way, then you're going to run out of business, right? And so you get benefits from the Inflation Reduction Act, as if tax breaks will happen over time, right? Those aren't going to last forever, right? Can you really do this in an effective way in a global scale where you're competing against everybody else? And we think we can. Now, in order to pull that off, we need a reliable supply chain at reasonable prices. Europe faces the same thing as the United States on where are you going to get the lithium and the iron and the phosphate and the electrolytes and all the precursor materials. And some are starting to be done in Europe and done in the United States, but do they have the reliability? Can they do it at scale? All that is part of the mix.
Let's now stick with the planned gigafactories in the US. Can you give us a glimpse? How many planned gigawatt hours are realized today in the US, and how many are planned in general?
Sure. So the initial factory that we're building by the end of next year is a two gigawatt hour lines, right? So there'll be one line side by side in the same big, long, skinny building I mentioned, 2 gigawatt hours each. So the capacity will be about four. We might be just under that. You know, we got to scale up and get better at, you know, producing. And then within 2 to 3 years, after the first one, we'll take the lessons. We're going to build three more at the same site. We already have the 270 acres to do it on. The initial factory is on about 70 acres. So by 27, 28, you know, we think we'll be doing up to 18 to 20 gigawatt hours.
From what you said previously, I was thinking that you might be considering stationary storage as a potential product. Let me ask you, what are your customers and what products do you see your batteries?
We're in the battery cell business, so we're not doing battery packs, right? So our, you know, we're close relationship with Lion Energy, who does battery packs. We have a relationship with four or five other companies that really do battery storage solutions. So they're the ones who are really deep down inside working the battery solution for industrial applications. And then they want from us reliable, long range LFP batteries that will last for 15 to 20 years instead of 6 or 8. And so they're really the offtake people. And we have four or five. Lion Energy is one, but we're intentionally not providing our initial factory load when we get it, you know, going in a year and a half. We're not going to provide all to one company. We want to have four, five, six main customers that are using them.
So if I get that right, you are producing LFP prismatic cells. Can I imagine them as to be all the same size, form factor, and then you just sell them to other companies, to clients who then will build packs for different applications?
The 105 amp hour, the 310 amp hour, we have a small pilot line in China with some of our machines that we set up so we can take, like, I'll give an example. Somebody in the U.S. says, oh, we have some lithium iron phosphate we think is ready to go. We can take a small amount, put it there, make a few in our little small production line, and so we can then test it, validate it. And so instead of waiting till our factory's done, we get to do that now. And so those are the two typical ones, right? We think the 310, we can get to about 314 amp hour in terms of at really high end. But that's the main products of the main initial line. And then related to it, nearby, just at the same facility, we're going to have a foundry line, an innovation foundry line, which is really a much smaller. And that's where you can play with different chemistries, play with different manufacturing techniques. Because one of the lessons we've gotten from the last 5 or 6 years, really from our relationship with some chief scientists in the US and Europe, is we always see it every day, new announcements about some new chemistry. Oh, this is the greatest new thing. If you just add, you know, if you just add some gold into it, it will be even better, right? And that works in a small chemistry lab. You might get better electron flow. But is that scalable and manufacturable at a large scale in a productive way? And so our foundry will be a way that we can kind of experiment with that.
So you're producing LFPs, lithium iron phosphate at first. Give us a quick glimpse. How much energy density will your first cells possess?
For European numbers, I'd say about 170 to 180 watt hour per kilogram.
We, of course, ask ourselves, how fast can they be recharged? A stationary device or an application, they're not so much focused on to quick charging, fast charging, but do you have just a number? How much C rates are we talking?
Yeah, so typically we do a 0.5 C for battery storage kind of, you know, uses, because that's sufficient for almost everybody for charging, discharging. But we can do it at constant at 1 C or even 2 C if needed. So that's why I think originally when people were looking at car batteries, they weren't doing it. They were doing much faster because they really wanted it, those kind of things. But in the battery storage space and many industrial applications, 0.5 C, 1 C, it all, you know, works perfectly fine.
Well, then let's now talk about the supply chain. In general, we know you need some lithium, you need some copper, you need graphite, you need the electrolyte, and of course, phosphorus. You want to keep that in America, but now you said as well, you have some production sites in China. How does that look? How do you set up your supply chain?
Lithium iron phosphate, like our first factory, needs about 7,000 tons a year. When we expand those next three, now we're talking 25 to 35,000 tons a year. There's nobody in the U.S. right now producing that quantity at the quality percentage level you need, right? But there are people working at it, right? And so they have some. And so we're able to validate what they're doing. So it's really, you know, it's an interesting, crazy mix of things. So we have at least 5 or 6 suppliers of each major, probably the 10 or 12 most important components. And there'll be in that list, there'll be 2 or 3 in China, 1 or 2 in Korea or Japan. There'll be 1 or 2 in Europe and 2 in North America. That's just a typical kind of range.
I think it's very smart to rely on redundant suppliers worldwide. That's a very smart thing business-wise. Where do you end up price-wise? What's the price of one single LFP prismatic cell?
I don't know the answer to that. I say that because, well, I say that in a funny way. So, you know, we were talking with a finance group recently, and they were wanting to project, what are you going to sell the battery cells for in 2027, 28, 29? If you ask a finance person and said, well, what's the oil price going to be in 3 years? They don't know exactly, but there is such a 100-year track record of oil pricing or the price of gold and certain raw materials that they're very comfortable with looking at the past, projecting against interest rates, what's the exchange rate in Europe and the dollar and all that stuff. And they're very comfortable with discussions. But when you say, what's a battery, an LFP battery, 310 amp hour going to be worth, there is not a robust enough historical market to know. You almost can't even do a price in Europe and the United States right now. It's so varied. It's so small. The price of those kind of cells and the raw materials of those tend to go together, right? Lithium prices are dropping, right? Battery prices are dropping, right? Lithium prices go up and some materials, the other ones go up. So the gap tends to stay okay, we think. And so, that's the important part. If you can produce and manufacture effectively, efficiently, then the input price and the output price will have enough of a gap that we can be competitive.
So you feel confident that if you produce the battery cells, you can meet the price point that is currently set up by the competitors, right? I think that's kind of at least what we're talking about, right?
I mean, the hardest one is China because their economy is slowed a little bit. They're hurting. There's oversupply. That's really why the price has gone down, right? So the real question would be what will China look like in a year or 2 or 3, right? It's not, I mean, this 2 years ago, the price was very different, and China wasn't predicting it being where it is today, right? And so that predictive modeling is what I was getting at. It's really hard for anybody because you don't have 100 years of the Dow Jones and, you know, all the EU common market, you know, stock exchanges. But we're comfortable that it will go up some, and we don't have to be lower than. We need to be in the ballpark, because if we're slightly higher, well, we provide a reliability. We have transportation differences. We get a little bit of made in USA and made in Europe and all those kind of things. It all has some value. It's not worth 3 times more value, but it's worth some more value. And then we can talk some more, if you'd like, about defense applications where it's even more value, I think.
Let me summarize at this point. So you're building up a battery cell gigafactory in the US. The unique selling point of these cells is not the domestic market, is probably the price we've been talking about a lot. So let's jump into the supply chain of the battery materials. Again, you have some aluminum, you have some copper, you have lithium, you have graphite and phosphorum. So which one of these metals are probably, when it comes to price, right now a big issue? Where is the most fluctuation when you look at a price table?
So we need lithium iron phosphate, right? To make lithium iron phosphate, you know, your listeners know, you know, you lithium and iron and phosphate, it's at very high quality, certain types of density and blends, and then you heat it all up and blend it all in an effective way to make LFP. So for us, it's, you know, we're not trying to be the maker of LFP. We're looking for people who can supply LFP to us. So we also have an upstream of people that are doing kind of what we're doing for battery cell production, right? Will U.S. and European LFP suppliers, where are they getting their lithium and their iron and their phosphate to put it together? We're inherently, you know, working with our supply, you know, future supply chain and partners on what's their risks and where are they at and what their price point is. And then we're part of that same accordion of uptake and offtake, right? And so that's what makes it kind of fun, kind of interesting, but also very dynamic.
John, I'd like to ask a bit more about the value. On your website, you state that you have the safest, longest lasting, most reliable and eco-friendly batteries. So I was wondering, what are you optimizing for in your cells? Because we know you can optimize for high performance, you can optimize for longevity. Which of those values do you feel are the most important for your company as a USP? So is it the ecological aspect, so the recycling and that all that will work very well? Or is that maybe the density, the power density?
In the end, the real value added is the lithium iron phosphate is so much longer lasting, right? And then we're doing prismatic cells, which is, as your listeners know, is you know, you're doing folding and you get a very tight density. And so that's really why, and before about 2 or 3 years ago, you couldn't really do, no one was really doing prismatic high gigawatt level folding, right? And the reality is the Chinese figured out how to do it, right? They worked at it and so their prismatic machines are pretty darn good, right? But they're not perfect, right? So we think is we can take that prismatic ability that people that's now ubiquitous, right? People can do this, right? And then use smart production with Siemens and Honeywell and Rockwell and bringing that to bear into that machine line, and you can take it to even the next level, right? So it's really smart manufacturing where if there's an error in the chemistry, you know it right away, not, you know, when the battery cell comes out at the other end. So you can now recycle and fix that. You get farther along and you're injecting electrolyte and something's not right. You can find it out then. Only a little bit is damaged, right? Not to scale, and you can fix it and keep going. So we think bringing in that high-end manufacturing will allow us to take the lithium iron phosphate and do really high quality, right? With really high density. So for battery storage, it lasts a really long time, right? Now we're talking 6,000 plus life cycles instead of the 2,000 or 3,000 you typically get in EV car, right? The difference from pouch and kind of the circular ones is, you know, it seems goofy, but in a circular system, we remember from our old math class when we were kids, right? Even if it's a really skinny circle, that line, the inside and the outside has a different area, right? And when you get into cell chemistry for, you know, all the scientist geeks, that affects the performance over time. It affects breakdown. You have gaps. So we really think we have the right solution for things that need to last a long time. Who wants to replace your home storage, you know, battery stuff every 6 or 8 years? We're used to that for cars, right? And cars, people after 6 or 8 or 9, I like the new model, whatever. But you don't want to go put a battery storage solution on connected to your roof and your solar and have to replace it, right? That's too expensive.
Absolutely. But it would be very new to me that all these lithium iron phosphate home storage systems, they wouldn't last for shorter than 2,000 cycles, for example. Now you mentioned 6,000 cycles. Where does that come from? Are you testing your first cells already in a cycling system or something?
I think the cycle part is not the long-term challenge. One of the hard parts for people is the calendar cycle, right? So you can hook it to a machine and just keep cranking up cycles and it goes, it's still good. And every battery has some drop off, right? But then they plateau a little bit for a long time, for a while. But is there an aging component, right? I heard something interesting that I'm not smart enough chemistry wise to know, but it was talking about as you add in the LMFP, right? And you add that in, and so you get some better performance. But a very smart PhD chemistry person said, you know what happens over time, because electrolyte breaks down the M part, right? And over time, LMFP turns into LFP. I was like, really? Right? And so one of the challenges for everybody is, as new chemistries, new things, will they last and be durable? And we know LFP will, because we've been doing this for more than 10 years.
I had one thought before when you were talking about the production line, that you are using AI to maybe sense errors very early on in the production process. Because we all know if a batch gets bad, this can be very, very expensive. So I was thinking maybe it's not even only a quality advantage. This could actually be a price advantage if you don't lose like an entire batch of battery cells that you need to toss and restart the entire process. This can be very, very pricey. I know this from the wafer industry. So what's your take on that? Do you see an advantage there as well on the horizon?
Part of our manufacturing, engineering work is figuring out where are those offtake points, right? You have this big long thing. Where is the right points where you can make that decision and pull material off without having to stop the machine and let things keep running? Everybody tries to do that already, don't get me wrong. But if you can recycle those parts early, and we can talk some more about recycling if you like, then it's much easier to recycle just the chemistry part, or just after a certain part, than after you've assembled it. And now you got metal box and all these other parts and everything else.
I know it's quite hard to recycle LFP batteries since they're not as worthy as NMC cells. You don't have any cobalt, you don't have any nickel to recycle. So the expensive materials are not even in the cell. So do you think it's worth the process even?
We're going to do some, like we were just talking about, Leonard, some of that recycling in stride. But that's not a bulk recycling problem, right? You hope you don't have tons of stuff that has to be recycled, right? I think the real art form is the recycling of the products when you're done, right? When it's no longer value added, or if you had one that's badly damaged, right? And I think that's actually where innovation is kind of happening. Because right now, people want to do those batteries, like you said, Patrick, for getting out one or two of the materials, right? So it's slightly cost effective, but not great. But those things are hard to come by anyway, so it's worth it. But when we start electrifying so much more, then there'll be lots of LFP coming off. So if you can recycle effectively and efficiently, it will be worth it because there's a demand for those materials to be used. The interesting part, I think one of the things that we think is kind of fun, and we're partnering with Lion Energy on this, is if we do our job right, let's say we get 16 to 24 years out of a battery pack. Well, that means a battery produced in, right, December, Christmas of 2025. Well, that means until 2041, you hopefully won't be recycling it, right? Well, that's pretty far off. So we're trying to work with how will recycling happen in 15 to 20 years versus how we do it today. Because one of the things about today, I would call it heavy-handed recycling, right? The recycling kind of is take the whole EV battery, throw it into a machine, chop it up into little tiny parts. Then you use magnets and chemistry and vibration, all this stuff. And you slowly pull out the parts you want, throw away some of the other stuff. Can we make our battery cell ready to go into battery packs where the whole thing falls apart really fast? Like you almost hit the button and it almost disassembles, right? And then you've already separated most of the materials, right? Now, no one's quite doing that today, but we're talking, 5, 10, 15 years from now. If you do it that way, it probably would be cost effective because you wouldn't have to use all the energy and the chemistry to do what we do today.
As a former retired two-star general, how did you end up in the battery game? What did you specialize before? What did you do in the Army?
I didn't do anything with batteries other than we used a lot. I was a Corps of Engineer officer. I was fortunate to serve in Germany as a lieutenant back in the late 80s before the wall came down. I served in Europe more recently from 2008 to 11 as the head of the Europe District of the Army Corps of Engineers. So I have great memories of Europe and experiences in the Army that I think for me, I got introduced through a friend of mine to ABF, and ABF was looking for some organizational skills, leadership skills. I know enough about chemistry to, talk about it. I wouldn't be a good chemist, right? And so I think that's what I'm bringing, organization and leadership part to it.
Thank you very much, John. That's it for today. Once more, thank you very much for your time and your expertise. That was a great talk. Now, dear listeners, are you convinced that America does need a domestic cell production? Make sure to comment below the podcast. That's it for today. See you next time. Bye-bye.